My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I am speaking with Marika Biagio. Marika, welcome to All Classical.
Thanks. Wonderful to be here.
Yeah, the title of your book is Parlor Games, and it's published by Doubleday. It's a nice title. I think the title really fits the mood of the book, let's put it that way.
I'm glad to hear that. It wasn't the original title. I had given it the title A Most Dangerous Woman. But my editor explained because there were a couple of competing books coming out with similar titles that we best move on to something different.
Yeah, well, this is a subtler title, and yes. I think a little more... a little more playful, probably, yeah. Okay, the book is about a woman named May Dugas. That's one name that she has.
Yes.
She acquires names like dogs acquire fleas.
And, absolutely.
Yeah, and she moves around the world a lot, and there's a device, a literary device, known as the unreliable narrator. And I've always had a lot of trouble working that, but you seem to have done it to a turn, and she's a specific kind of unreliable narrator, because what she tells you is, I think, what she believes. I think that she really sees the world this way, and even though it's not the way the world is that a good assessment?
You're absolutely right on with that. May is a real person who lived during the Gilded Age, and when I first came across her story, I did spend a couple of months researching her and thinking, how am I going to convey this story? I knew it was a rich story, such an adventurous woman she was. And one day, the first line popped into my head. I believe, dear reader, and these words come from the bottom of my heart, that I can trust you. And I knew I had gotten her. I had gotten inside her head. Yes, the story is purposefully told in first person because I wanted her to justify her actions. I wanted her to explain to the world why she had done the things she did.
Do you know the book Gentlemen Prefer Blondes?
No, I have not read it.
It's okay. I recommend it highly. Anytime I find a used copy in a bookstore, I buy it and give it to somebody who hasn't read it yet. There's a character in there named Lorelei Lee. Mm-hmm. And except for the fact that May is probably a little smarter than Lorelei, they are the same person. They view the world in exactly the same way, that they have certain requirements, and only certain men can meet those requirements, and their job in life is to meet men like that.
Fascinating. I will have to look that one up. Yes, of course, May does have a sociopathic streak to her, but she's quite cunning. She's very clever, and I would say she's not simple in the respect that her motives are complex. She does things for a variety of reasons, which I think makes, I hope, for some of the fun in the reading, because then the reader really has to think, how do I feel about this person? You know, is she completely bad? Well, no. Look, she helps her mother buy a house.
She loves her family, and she's
absolutely
very loyal to them, even
yes,
when they're not loyal to her.
Yes. She helps her brothers get started in life. She never forgets them.
Yeah, there's something called the main chance. She, from an early age, she knew the main chance. Even living, I realized, I said, Menominee, that's not a town in Michigan, it's a town in Wisconsin. But there's one in both places.
Yes.
There
mm-hmm.
is, yeah. I guess the Menominee were a native tribe
yes.
in the area. The first young man that she sets her sights on is probably one of the richer young men in Menominee.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and she knows, I guess her mother helps her along that path, you know, that you need somebody to take care of you, May.
Well, her mother wants her to marry well, and that was really the only avenue open to women at that time to move up the class and socioeconomic ladder was really to marry up. So her mother hoped that she would, and she latches on to the son of one of the lumber barons of Menominee, and it seems to be a very good match, at least her mother thinks so, but May has other plans in mind.
Yeah. Well, my mother always told me that it's just as easy to fall in love with a rich girl as a poor girl, but I've never really had that happen to me. I guess maybe one time, but it didn't work out so well. So that's really, in effect, what May's mother tells her, right?
Absolutely. She wants her to marry well. She wants her to be able to live a better life than she lived. Both of her parents were poor French-Canadian immigrants.
Yeah. So the book takes place starting in the 1880s.
Yes.
And runs through 1917 is one of the last dates that we see. And it starts with a trial in yes. Menominee. What is the trial about?
Well, May's longtime friend and sometime lawyer accuses her of extortion, taking money from her. They were companions for many, many years, on and off, probably for about 15 years. And slowly but surely, Frank, her friend, lost her money. And when she was close to broke, she tried to get it back from May, and May said, well, no, you gifted all that money to me. So the trial is about whether or not those monies were freely given or extorted.
Mm-hmm. And Frank is a woman. Frank is was a some version of a liberated woman for the time, would you
say? She was. She was one of the first women to get a law degree from the University of Michigan. So it's very unusual for women to practice law in that time period. But she did. She set up a law practice outside of Chicago. She took her business to Menominee for a while when she decided to live with May and her family there. Very unusual for that time.
Yeah, now, I don't know how much you want me to give away to the story here, but at the early point in the story, May has to flee to Chicago or decides it's in her best interest to do it. Do you want to tell us why that is?
Sure. She actually had set her sights on Chicago at quite a young age. She saw at that time Chicago was this, you know, the sparkling new frontier of modernity, and it offered career opportunities. In fact, there were a lot of young women and young people finding their way to Chicago from the Midwest in those years, and she sees it as the land of opportunity, as her chance to make it big, to begin to explore the world. She's not satisfied with Menominee, not even marrying the son of the lumber baron in Menominee. So she believes that she has become pregnant by her boyfriend in Menominee, and whether or not she actually has been pregnant is something that the reader has to decide, because she either uses this pregnancy as a ploy to escape Chicago, or she decides she must, escape to Chicago, or she decides she must go to Menominee because her reputation would be ruined were she to have a child before nine, when it was obvious that the child had been conceived out of wedlock. So she runs off to Chicago, and then on her way there discovers, oops, she wasn't pregnant after all, but it's too late to turn back.
She strings poor Robbie, that's his name.
Robbie.
Right? She strings poor Robbie along for a while, though, doesn't she?
She does. She needs his allowance to help her get started, and she keeps him on the line for several months until she gets her own start, probably not her first choice, but at the best bordello in all of Chicago.
Yeah, it's a great meet. She's window shopping, walking through the department stores, Marshall Fields, whatever the big stores were in Chicago at the time, and starting to look a little shabby, perhaps, and looking with longing. She's like one of, looking at a hungry person looking at a meal, and she runs into a pianist at the department store.
The Boston store,
yeah, who's also a piano professor in a cat house.
Right.
Claude Moncrief. Tell us about old Claude.
Well, Claude is a character unto himself. I really enjoyed writing about Claude because he matches May in cleverness. And they have a wonderful yes. dinner together at the Windsor House in Chicago, and during which they basically are playing this little game with each other. She thinks that she's trying to extract information from him about how to find her way in the city, how to meet wealthy men. And he, all the time, is really luring her to this bordello. And in the end, she decides to try out the bordello because basically she's hungry and her scheme of meeting a wealthy man is not working. And this is what Claude tells her, that this is the best way for her to meet a wealthy man is at this bordello.
It's the best one in town. It's Miss Carrie Watson's.
Has a reputation to this day.
Well, the thing that I liked about this is that at first May is offended, because even though May not have, let's say the most pristine idea of how to go in the world, the idea of actually working in a bordello is a bit much, and that lasts for about 20 seconds as she mulls over the possibilities. And then she needs to make sure that his bona fides is okay, that he's not just a sleazy recruiter, which in fact he is, but he has a little more class than that, and she believes him, right?
Yes. In fact, he reminds her a bit of her father, who she really had a very dear relationship with. So it wasn't hard for, I think, them to come to an understanding. Though she does manage to extract something from him in the bargain, she wants him to take her shopping for a new dress and new shoes so that she can make a good impression on Carrie Watson. So it's as if they each get something from each other in this bargain.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Chicago is just the first stop. She's a world traveler. She goes to, among other places, she goes to Portland briefly. I thought that was fun. But Shanghai, Tokyo, London, she goes around the world and finds men in all of these places who wish to take care of her, some of whom are maybe a little shadier than her even, and, you know, that's kind of a mutual exploitation society for a while. Tell us about Shanghai. I think that's probably one of the better places.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I have to say that, think about it, a woman on her own traveling the world at this time was, again, highly unusual. May certainly had courage and guts to go to these places on her own. But Shanghai,
she never has anything but total faith that she's going to land on her feet.
Absolutely. Yeah. Supreme self-confidence. And Shanghai is an interesting stop. She ends up there quite by happenstance after having gotten in a bit of trouble in San Francisco, and the most convenient way to get away was to take the first ship, which happened to be sailing for Shanghai. So it wasn't necessarily by design that she ended up there, but she did have quite an adventure once there. She went with her one of her accomplices, who she quickly parted ways with, and then she went on to meet a man. And as you say, some of these men that she comes into league with aren't themselves pristine and pure in their motives. She becomes his mistress until she discovers that he has a family. And then she manages to work that situation to her benefit as well.
Yeah. There are lines beyond which she won't go. She has her own set of morals, as different as they might be from some of us, right?
Yes. Okay. She picks men that have the money and can afford to be taken. It's not as if she's taking the last drop of money from these men. She finds wealthy men, and as even her Pinkerton pursuer once said, the men she found were fools.
Yep. She has a nemesis. His name is Reed Doherty, and he is a Pinkerton. And the thing about Pinkertons, as some people may or may not know, is that they were a detective agency, probably the first detective agency in the United States. And they have a really vile history because, among other things, they were used as goons to break up strikes. They were anti-labor. They were anti anything liberal. They would break up offices of liberal organizations. Pinkerton himself was a bit of a creep, and yet they were the go-to guys for almost anything. Now Reed Doherty has been hired to do what exactly?
Well, Reed Doherty is the Pinkerton agency's woman criminal expert. So it seems whenever there is a woman criminal that has to be chased down, Reed Doherty gets the assignment. So they first come into contact in Chicago when Doherty is hired by the wealthy banker whose son is very attracted to and, in fact, has asked May to marry him. So this is Reed has a tendency to undo her plans, and he does manage to undo this first marriage proposal. And then he tends to cross paths with her around the world, which some of my readers have said, well, that's completely unrealistic. And I have to remind them, well, this is a true story. And in fact, this particular detective did specialize in women criminals, and that's how he came to cross paths with her so many times.
So he's based on a real person as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And this was the early era of modern travel. There were railroads, there were steamships, there was telegraphs. You could send a telegraph across the ocean in those days. So It could happen. I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Marika Biagio. Her last name is spelled B-I-A-G-G-I-O. Title of the book is Parlor Games, and it's published by Doubleday. I'm always reminded that Dashiell Hammett worked for the Pinkertons for quite a while and began to loathe himself so much for the jobs he was doing that it kind of colored his the entire rest of his life, his politics, even his art, because the Continental Op was clearly a Pinkerton, one of his creations. So we don't like the Pinkertons, do we?
Oh, they have a mixed history. Now, the new book, Hour of Peril, that has just come out, does talk about how William Pinkerton, the founder of the Pinkertons, saved President Lincoln's life on the way to the inauguration. There was probably an assassination afoot that was likely to be successful until the Pinkertons stepped in. Now, William Pinkerton himself was an abolitionist and quite liberal in his ideology. So Lincoln, in fact, went on to ask him to found the work on the Secret Service. But after his sons took over, then things took a turn in terms of how the agency began to work, and they were hired by industrialists to break strikes. Their methods were often quite outside, on the edge of the law. So then their reputation did suffer with the public. But, yes, Dashiell Hammett admitted that many of his characters were based on those that he had met during his work as a Pinkerton. So it served him in some way in his later years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even Sam Spade is not a very nice man.
No.
No. The other thing about Reed Doherty is that he needs May as much as May despises him because he's like Ahab and she's the white whale, you know? She is his life's work, in effect.
Yeah, they develop somewhat of a symbiotic relationship. I mean, there's even a certain sexual tension between them initially.
Uh-huh.
At the very first meeting, May finds him to be handsome in a not quite classic way. And it seems that his fascination with her at times goes beyond the professional. So, yeah, they do have an interesting relationship.
Yeah, in fact, at one point when he confronts her in some other city again about some other matter, she accuses him of having lied to her the very first time that he met her, and that she sees that as her moral edge over Reed Doherty.
Yes, and she thinks that he's been brought in on matters that are altogether private and none of his business, that she's done nothing illegal.
She has friends that she accumulates. One was Sue Marie, the one who she parts company with in San Francisco, and then Daisy. When she was working at Miss Watson's, she held herself aloof from the other women working in the brothel, and it worked to her detriment. So she's decided she needs to have at least one good woman friend to accompany her. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I think that she learned that it was not so smart on her part to hold herself apart from the other girls, and that, in fact, a woman accomplice was the best accomplice to have. This was unlike some of the other women criminals who were maybe a little not as classy in their work as May was, who had male accomplices. And this ended up serving her quite well over the years.
One of the items that keeps turning up here and has enormous importance in May's life is the diamond necklace. Tell us a little bit about the diamond necklace, because it figures into the story in several key places.
Yes, when she lands her first thousands of dollars on a breach of promise claim, one of the things that she does is treat herself to a yellow diamond necklace, a stunning piece. And it becomes a symbol of her attachment to wealth and her love of jewels and the high life. And at some point later on, it goes missing. And the reason for its disappearance becomes a part of the story. You know, did she lose it? Was it stolen? And it crops up later in the story, and then the reader it has to reflect back on how the necklace came to be missing in the first place. But it does. There is that necklace runs through the whole story.
Yeah, I also love the fact that she accumulates all these names. She's Pauline, I forget what, Pauline something, Davidson. when she goes to the bordello. But my favorite one, of course, is the Baroness de Vries.
Yes.
How does she become the Baroness de Vries?
Well, the Baron de Vries sees her from across the room at the Opera House in London and is simply stunned and will not have her turn him down. He pursues her, finally meets her, finally she agrees to dine with him, and he has fallen head over heels in love with her. Now, at first to her, this is a dream come true. Here is a man with wealth beyond her wildest dreams. And though she is a little bit reluctant, she does allow him to court her. At first, she finds him to be arrogant. But over time, she warms to him and they do marry. Though she's not sure after a time if the life of a staid housewife is for her.
Yes, and they're from Holland?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's the whole country is a little bit cold for May's liking. She wants something a little warmer. She has flings with people from Mexico City. Coffee barons and politicians. She's involved in a it's not a swindle really, but a shady deal in Mexico City.
Yes, yes.
Her adventures are really wonderful. Now, I'm curious about how much of the real May Dugas you used here and how much, you know, flowed from your imagination.
Well, in fact, most of the incidents are real. There is a self-published book that I discovered in Menominee written by a Chicago journalist who interviewed the Pinkerton that followed her around the world and recounted all these adventures. Mm-hmm. And then I did find a lot of newspaper reports that corroborated many of these adventures. So in fact, you know, her trips to Shanghai and Tokyo and Mexico City and London and the south of France, all those were real. All of the men that she met were real. So what I filled in was basically the day-to-day life, the conversations, how she pulled off some of her schemes, but all of the schemes really happened.
I think the most successful thing you did was giving us her mental state, her thoughts, how she viewed the world, I guess her worldview, for want of a better term, and why she acted the way she did, because she always had justifications for what she did.
Yes, that was really the fun part,
of course,
about writing this. Once I got her character, and it did take me a while trying to figure out, you know, what made her tick? How did she view the world? What did she think of all these things she did? How did she feel about these men? Did she or did she not love any of them? You know, once I got a sense of who she was, it was really actually easy to write this novel because I did find a certain coherence in her character. I did feel like I was able to get inside of her, and I loved the first-person voice once I did that. I almost had this feeling that I was May and that I was telling her story for her. It was a wonderful feeling.
When you mention love, I think the one liaison that she had where she might really have been in love was Johnny Graham.
You're right. Johnny, if she loved anybody, it was Johnny. Johnny, in his innocence, would have been her undoing. Here was a man that trusted her, that did not have any suspicions about her, to the extent that she couldn't bear to tell him about her past, because she knew it would ruin him. So I felt that if she did love anybody, it would be Johnny that she would have a soft spot for.
And so she did, yeah. And alas, it comes to a bad end, which we won't talk about. But we have a mutual friend, and we know you know this person from your book group.
Yes.
How much help was your book group? Writers always ask me, should I join a book group? Should I take a writing course? And I always say, take one writing course and then write. But book groups have an up and down reputation. How was yours?
Mine was great, and I think it really depends a lot on the chemistry of the group, which is hard to predict. You know, it's how the people come together and how they help each other. We happened to be pretty well matched, I think, in terms of where we were in our own writing careers. So we were able to meet each other where we were. And then I think in order to benefit from a writing group, one needs a certain level of confidence oneself, because you always have to be able to screen the feedback that you get from your peers. If they don't understand what you're trying to accomplish in your work, then they're not going to be able to help you. And if you don't understand what you're trying to accomplish, then they certainly won't be able to help you. But I think, in a way, writing is like being a musician. You can't do it well unless you practice. And for me, that was the single most important thing about learning how to become a writer, was writing. This is actually my fourth novel. Mm-hmm. Our writing group had really fallen apart because each of us started going our own ways by the time I started writing this particular book. But unquestionably, I learned a lot from them.
Yeah, my one experience with a writing group, and my larger experience as a technical writer, where you can't fall in love with your own prose, because as a technical writer, somebody's going to change it no matter what you do. So you develop a distance from your own work in a way. But writing fiction is more personal and more emotional than writing technical specs. And you have to know where the criticism from your group is real and where not to become offended by. You can never be offended by anything that goes on in a book group, but you have to. That's the hard thing, I guess, is to learn what's good and what isn't in criticism.
I think you're really right on there. You have to really be able to sift through it, and I think being non-defensive is an important asset for any writer, because let's face it, there's no such thing as a perfect novel. There's no such thing as a writer who has reached the pinnacle of accomplishment. There's always more that one can do. So I think if you're going to grow as a writer, you have to learn how to take in feedback, and you have to learn how to really evaluate it and discern what is helpful and what is not. And even some of the feedback that you think initially is not helpful, well, they don't understand what I'm trying to convey in my book. What it may be telling you is you haven't done a good job of trying to present what it is you're trying to get across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's taking a mature attitude is very important. But yes. In most things, it's most of the times I refuse to take a mature attitude, but... So now here you are with this wonderful book, and I really like this book. What's going on for you now? Are you in the midst of another book? Are you finished with it? What's going on?
I'm probably about one half to two thirds the way through another novel. This one also based on a real person, happened to be Wilson Follett's daughter. Wilson Follett, the famous literary critic. His daughter, who was homeschooled, was a brilliant young woman, writer, child writer prodigy, published her first novel when she was 12 years old.
Wow.
And but her life did not fulfill the promise, its earlier promise.
Yeah.
Fascinating story.
So do you scour histories for interesting characters that pop up? How do you find these characters?
Well, various places. This particular story about Barbara Follett, I happened to find in a Utney Reader a few years ago. I just keep my eyes open. The subjects of an earlier novel was a story in the New York Times. I'm fascinated by real characters that perhaps whose story hasn't been told, because I think readers have a certain fascination for real people. I know I do. So that's where I look to for my material.
Yeah, before we started recording, I said, you know, I would really love to have the further adventures of May Dugas. Is anything like that possible, do you think?
Yes, because one of the interesting things that happened is after this trial, in fact, the year that this trial ends, she adopted an infant boy, which would have been, for anybody who knows May, quite out of character. So it raises all sorts of questions as to how this came about. So, you know, some of my readers have asked, is there a sequel? And I think there could be. It kind of depends upon how things go with this book now, and whether there's another idea in the wings, or whether May seduces me back to write more about her.
A seductive character she is. She had me right from the get-go, so... I'd like to thank you for coming in, Marika. Marika Biagio, B-I-A-G-G-I-O. Title of the book is Parlor Games, published by Doubleday. I look forward to reading your new book.
Thanks, Ed. Great to talk to you.
You've been listening to Author Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.